morning. I'd first like to apologize. I have a terrible cold, so you'll have to excuse the voice and the hacking that may come within your argument. We're going to call the, and I have to tell you one other thing. We ordinarily have a class, high school class, come in. They are part of a court with class program that we have. They've been invited to come. They've gotten materials on this case. They'll meet with retired Chief Justice Day at noon. And then my wind-up is, my conclusion is they haven't arrived yet. So they may come in, and that will be 22 people, and I hope that they're coming in will not disturb the argument. So the first case is 97-0873, Burnt v. Burnt. Mr. Bundy from the Terwilliger firm is first up.
Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the Court. My name is John Rundy. I represent the appellants Richard and Esther Barrett. Richard and Esther Barrett come here today asking this Court to provide them with a right we all believe to be the bedrock of the Bill of Rights, the right to a trial by jury, the right to a full and fair hearing. As you know, the Court of Appeals asked this Court to decide two issues. The first issue is, what standard of review applies in issue preclusion cases? And the second issue is the status of Dick and Esther Barrett as the parents of Stephen Barrett a sufficient basis, standing alone, to invoke issue preclusion? For reasons set forth in my brief, and for the reasons I will suggest to you today, the answers to those questions are that the standard of review in a case such as this is de novo. At the appellate level, this presents a constitutional question of law, and therefore is one that this Court will address de novo. And the answer to the second question is that the mere status of Dick and Esther Barrett as parents of Stephen Barrett is not sufficient to invoke issue preclusion. In reading my brief and comparing it to the brief of the respondents, you will note a significant issue which throughout this litigation the respondents have failed to address and have refused to address. This is the same issue that the trial court failed to analyze. That issue is generally referred to as the privity issue. It is our position that the threshold issue that this court must decide is whether or not Richard and Esther Barrett were in privity with their son Stephen in his criminal trial.
Counsel, if they weren't in privity, just so I understand this, the obligation which was a court order to, quote, supervise when the son had the custody, didn't that create that obligation? That created that privity obligation that when Stephen had the children, that the grandparents would be there. And tell me why I'm wrong then, that did not create that.
Because, Your Honor, in the first instance, that is not the obligation that was imposed. The reason that the children were in the home of Dick and Esther Barrett during the period of time that the criminal conviction says the abuse occurred was because the Honorable John Finn, Circuit Court Judge for Portage County, ordered the mother of the two children to place those children in the home of Dick and Esther Barrett as a condition of her bond. There was no court-ordered supervision of Dick Behrendt's ability to be with his children at that time?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what time periods we're talking about. First, as to the criminal conviction, and then as to these orders of placement.
Okay. In March of 1992.
90 what?
1992.
Got it.
There was a hearing before the Honorable James Mason. Judge Mason was the family court judge on the custody dispute between Lorelei Behrendt, now known as Lorelei Blader, and Dick Behrendt. That was, in effect, the final custody hearing. And at that hearing, Judge Mason found that no allegations of sexual abuse had been established. He further found the primary physical placement of the children would be with Stephen Behrendt. He provided visitation, if you will, to Lorelei Behrendt. The first opportunity for visitation that Lorelei Behrendt had was that same day, the same day as the court hearing. She took the children and she absconded. She did not return until May 24th. And at that time...
What year are we talking about?
Yes, of 92.
Okay, 91.
I'm sorry, I may be you're off. You're right, it's 91. She returned on May 24th, 1991. I'm
and
sorry.
It was March 91 that Mason ordered.
I'm sorry, I was a year off. You're correct.
Right.
So she returned on May 24th, 1991, and at that time she was facing a felony warrant for interference with custody of a child. And she made an agreement with the Portage County District Attorney that she would return the children. The Behrendts volunteered to allow the children to be in the home because of, not a court order, but rather general accusations that occurred in the past and her complaint that she believed that Stephen Behrendt was an abuser.
Counsel, they volunteered to whom?
The district attorney's office.
Okay, so the parents in the criminal case were in communication with the district attorney in the criminal case against the mother, in communication with the DA.
Correct.
And they were going to let the children in the home. Were they aware of the condition that Finn said, take steps to see to it that the children are with the father's parents during the pendency of these proceedings? Were they aware of that?
Generally aware of it, I would say yes. Although those facts have not been fleshed out in this instant case, but generally, yes.
They knew that the mother was accusing the father of a sexual assault on the children, right? The
yes.
Parents, your clients, knew
yes.
That. They knew that she had taken the children out of the state. They knew that she was now in on a criminal charge. And they knew there was concern, at least her concern, that their son had sexually abused the children.
Yes.
And to allow her to be released on bond, they agreed that the children could be in their home.
Well,
you said the parents volunteered to let the children be in the home.
Right, but not in an effort to allow her to be released on bond. That was just a condition of bond that the court imposed.
Okay, all right. All right.
The condition was on her to... All right. I mean, basically what the story, I think, to back up to that point in time, the judge wanted to know where these kids were going to be during the pendency of this criminal case. And so it was agreed that this was a neutral site, effectively.
Well, why wasn't the previous order giving the father custody, why wasn't that in effect?
It was.
Well, then why do we need a second order giving the children to the grandparents?
Well, because Judge Fenn, I think, in a way, did a, in effect, a modification of the family court order to the extent that...
Where does that authority come from?
Pardon me?
Where does that authority come from?
Because the court, in his bond hearing order, said that this order will stay into effect unless a court of competent jurisdiction changes it.
Was the father there? Did he consent? Did he go to the DA, or is any of this in the record?
None of it is actually in the record, Your Honor.
All right. So now we got the children as of May 24, 1991, in the grandparents' home. Right?
That's right.
All right.
What happened next was there was a flurry of activity by the family court lawyers representing both Stephen Barron and Lorelei Barron. And that resulted in a hearing before Judge Mason on July 5, 1991. And at that hearing, Judge Mason reaffirmed his belief that no sexual abuse had occurred, and he therefore released any conditions of supervision on anybody and reinstated his original March order.
Okay, tell me that date again, I'm sorry. What was the date of this Mason order?
July 5, 1991.
Okay.
So as of July 5, 1991, the placement of the children by family court order was to be following the March order. And it's our contention that Judge Fenn's bond statement in May was then superseded by the family court order, because Judge Fenn specifically foresaw that a family court judge may modify that order. And he said, this order is in effect until modified by a court of competent jurisdiction, which it was.
Well, what dates was Stephen accused of sexual assault?
The criminal complaint charged June 1, 1991, to August 1, 1991.
Was there a trial in the criminal case?
Yes.
Jury?
Yes.
And what dates were proved?
That's the real nub of the problem, in effect, because there were no dates proven. As this court was aware, in criminal cases, the jury can be instructed that they're not bound by the dates contained in the criminal complaint. And so there was an instruction on that. And so all we have is a jury finding that he was convicted as charged in the complaint, which then, in effect, creates that time frame.
Now, I see before me two packets containing the record. Any record here of that criminal case, so we know what the testimony was? In the record before this court.
The best record of the criminal case, in my opinion, that this court can review is Record 77.
Okay.
Now, what Record 77 is the petition for writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court that Stephen Barron filed with the Supreme Court in an effort to get his criminal conviction overturned.
So you're saying if we can look at the facts of his petition?
That has, I think, a relatively good recitation of those facts, yes.
Counsel, I note on page 6 of your brief that you quote from the trial court, and the trial court says, as I understand it, the plaintiffs are alleging a greater time frame than what was in the criminal complaint. So it does not cover the time periods that are greater than those times that were alleged in the criminal complaint. This is what bothers me, if that's correct. I guess my first question is, what is the time period alleged in the civil action? Then, I don't understand that if we're dealing with issue preclusion, and issue preclusion means issues that have been actually litigated in the previous action, if there's a greater time alleged in the civil complaint, then how can that possibly be the subject of issue preclusion? So, first question of what are the times alleged, and if they're greater, how can they possibly, the greater time possibly be subject to issue preclusion?
The short answer to that, Your Honor, is that the plaintiffs, during the pendency of this action at the trial court level, while the argument for issue preclusion was being made, orally amended their complaint to throw out the allegations in the complaint that fell outside the period of time of the criminal conviction, that is to say, June 1, 1991 to August 1, 1991.
Do we have that in the record?
Yes, it's in, yes. There's a footnote in my original brief in the Court of Appeals that cites to the record, and if the court would like, I can find it for you now, but it's in the record.
So now, for purposes of this record, we are dealing with the same time frame as the time frame alleged in the criminal complaint, 6191 to 8191.
Yes and no.
Okay.
All right. The yes part of that is that for that is what they would, that is what the plaintiffs would like to bind us to. However, we are dealing with not only liability, but we are dealing with damages. So the issue becomes whether or not these children were sexually abused at other times, and such that they're damaged by those other abuses, because they have contended in the original complaint and have contended throughout that the sexual abuse was of long-standing periods of time.
But if there are, if you go to trial, wouldn't the trial judge keep the evidence limited to that time frame?
No, the trial court judge in this case acknowledged that although the plaintiffs were going to limit the proof to the period of time that the criminal conviction fell within, that for purposes of other emotional damage, the other assaults would be admissible as an, I guess, mitigation of damages, if you want to argue that.
Is that in the record, too?
Yes.
That puts you in a real odd situation of arguing that Stephen committed lots of sexual assaults. I mean, that's what you'll be arguing then.
Right. Well, that's what we'd have to argue.
That's right. And that the ones contained in the time period of the criminal complaint only make up a few, and there are lots more, so their damages are, for the criminal complaint time frame, small compared to all the other sexual assaults that he committed. I mean, that's kind of in the box you're in, isn't it?
Well, and we're put into a further box by this order because of the fact that I think it's going to be factually and legally not in dispute that as of July 5, 1991, there was no prohibition requiring anybody to be supervised in the visitation of their children, because July 5, 1991 was the date of Judge Mason's order.
Well, suppose we just had 4 days. 4 days in which these grandparents had the children and were, let's just assume for the purpose of argument, they were under, they knew about the accusation against the father. They were aware that the court said they were to keep the children sober. Apparently, the inference is to take care of them against the father or anyone else. So you have 4 days. And suppose you had the sexual assault in the 4 days. That was the criminal case. Are you liable?
Well, I think for purposes of this argument, the question is does issue preclusion apply? And the answer is no.
Well, I changed the facts on you. I said that in the criminal case, the allegation was only as to July 1 to July 5.
Right. And I'm assuming, for purposes of this question, that there is a court-ordered obligation on them to
take care of the
take care of the children.
In effect, from July 1 to July 5. What about issue preclusion under those circumstances?
No.
Why not?
Because you still have to go back to the question of what the U.S. Supreme Court refers to as privity. And privity is no longer the term that the Supreme Court favors. They, in Montana versus the United States, changed the term. If you read Montana versus the United States, they will say privity is really a misnomer. We're not going to call it that anymore. We're going to ask the question, under those circumstances that you've just posed. We're going to ask the question, does Dick and Esther Barron in that situation, in the criminal case, do they represent the same legal interest as their son? And in order for them to represent the same legal interest, you would have to find, under Montana versus the United States, that the prosecution of that criminal case was done for the benefit of, or at the direction and control of, Dick and Esther Barron.
Well, let me just go back then. So all these dates we have are irrelevant from your standpoint because it's not important, because under no circumstances can there be issue preclusion in this case. That's your position.
That is correct.
Regardless of the dates.
That is correct.
Then it seems to me the natural outcome of your statement is there can never be issue preclusion in a criminal case, except maybe against the defendant, because the state is not supposed to bring cases for the benefit of particular individuals. They bring it for the benefit of all of us. So what's your answer to that?
The answer to that is found in the Restatement of Judgments 28. And the answer to that is that it's not true that a criminal conviction cannot be used against other non-parties. And those parties are specifically delineated in the Restatement of Judgments 28. And we don't fit in any of those groups of people. And I cite that in my brief.
Okay, what are the exceptions? I've got the restatement in front of me.
The exceptions are, it's always easier to find this when you're in your office.
Page 24 of your brief, folks.
Thank you, Justice Babbage. You have to have a relationship under the Restatement of Judgments, Section 46, which is wrongful death, Section 48, with a derivative claim such as loss of society and companionship, Section 56, relationship other of promises and intended beneficiaries under contract, and Sections 59 through 61, corporations, partnerships, and unincorporated associations.
I don't know whenever they'll be applicable in a criminal case. I don't know when they'd ever be applicable in a criminal case.
Well, I think it would be, for example, D.A. McCann in Milwaukee County has charged criminal charges for corporate negligence, criminal negligence, and issue preclusion would apply in that circumstance for, I believe, the vice president, if the president was convicted.
He'd be a defendant. I asked if it would be applicable to anyone who wasn't a defendant in the criminal case.
Only if you fit into those...
And I don't think you would. Can you give me an example of someone who would, if he wasn't a defendant?
Maybe an unindicted co-conspirator? A party to the crime?
Well, a party to crime is a defendant.
No, an uncharged party to the crime.
Well, what about your example? The vice president is not charged.
Well, Chief Justice Abramson believes that the conviction of the president would necessarily apply to the vice president, and I don't know, because the restatement envisions that that wouldn't be the case, that you could have the president charged, but...
So the president is charged, and then you think if there was a suit against the vice president, there'd be issue preclusion. That's your position?
That's what the restatement says.
Is that your position?
Based on what I know from the restatement, yes.
Could I ask, is Stephen the defendant in this case?
Yes, he is.
If you prevail and the parents are able to relitigate whether sexual assaults occurred, isn't in effect Stephen able to relitigate the same issue?
No. And, the respondents have filed with this court a recent Court of Appeals decision that deals with a motion for summary judgment, in effect, that is brought by the parties where there has been a previous adverse ruling. And Michelle T., I think, answers that question as well. The court in Michelle T. told the defendant, you've been previously convicted, you do not get to argue in this case whether or not the sexual abuse occurred. Now, I will say that I have considered the question that Justice Prosser has raised, which is, well, wouldn't Stephen Barrett's case be subject to summary judgment? And in fact, the respondents have filed a motion for summary judgment on Stephen Barrett. And theoretically, Stephen Barrett could have that fact found to be a fact, and he could be precluded from making that argument. But at that juncture, it seems to me that my motion for severance is then in order. I mean, it's no different, I could suggest it's no different than Attorney Malevsky or Attorney Masolia, the GAL or the divorce lawyer, having the same opportunity to argue that the sexual abuse didn't occur.
Are there any further questions? Okay, counsel, your time is up, and thank you. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. The next oral argument is split so that Mr. Peterson will take part of it, and Mr. Maloney will take the second part, which if he gets 15 minutes. Can you tell us how you're splitting this time and what issues, if any, you're dividing?
Well, we had two issues that were before this court on appeal. Number one was the issue preclusion, and the second question that was raised was the scope of discovery in this case with respect to an order that was issued by the trial court. I'd like to address at this time, Your Honors, the issue preclusion portion of this primarily, and then reserve for Mr. Maloney 15 minutes to talk about the discovery aspect of the case. One of the problems in this case, if I can be permitted to put it in a little bit of context, is that we've been litigating with the defense two entirely different actions almost from the inception of the case. The court asked the time period that we're talking about. On the record, and this is in record citation 94, page 23, I believe, we advised the trial court that we were limiting our time period for proof with respect to the negligent supervision claim to June 1, 1991 to August 1, 1991. And the reason we did that was a question of self-restraint on our part as counsel. We were bringing an action for these young children. We were trying to litigate their claim for damages, but not do any more damage to them. And when we began our case back in October of 1994, and through the inception of this case today, it's been our one problem we've dealt with, I think, all the way through. It's been the goal of the defendant respondents to retry the guilt or innocence of Stephen Burnt in the context of the civil action that we filed for negligent supervision. Stephen Burnt has already been prosecuted. He was tried to a jury in Portage County and convicted. He brought post-conviction motions before the trial court.
But, counsel, you're the one that sued the grandparents.
That's correct.
And if you had only sued Stephen, we wouldn't even be here.
We wouldn't even be here.
Well, is he still in the case?
Stephen is still in the case.
He's not represented here, apparently.
He is a pro se plaintiff or pro se defendant. He did not appeal in this case, and he was not involved in this appeal.
So then what is it, that you would have a civil action against him for liability and you've got a default judgment?
He has appeared in the underlying action. He's just not here on appeal. I will say, Mr. Rundy,
this has not gone to trial. This is here on an intermediate appellate.
That's correct. We were still in the midst of discovery and never got that far, unfortunately.
In the criminal trial, could the parents have put Stephen on the witness stand?
I'm sorry,
On the criminal trial, could the parents have put Stephen on the witness stand?
In the criminal trial?
I think he means civil.
In the civil trial? Well, I guess my position would be that under the tenets of issue preclusion that if Stephen Berndt got up and started to talk about his innocence or denying his conviction.
But what about the criminal trial? What control did the grandparents have during the criminal trial?
They were not parties to the criminal trial.
So they weren't allowed to call witnesses?
That's correct.
Did they testify?
I don't believe that they testified. It's my recollection of the record that they did not appear as witnesses.
Is there anything in this record to indicate that they had any control over the case?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well,
but that's not the nexus of this case.
Well, counsel.
Isn't the nexus or the question, I think, that my colleagues are getting at, is just basically a question of fundamental fairness. The fairness, if the defense is that this whatever happened didn't happen at this particular time and place, and then they don't have an opportunity in discovery or even a trial to make that defense, then doesn't that bother? That's the concern I see as far as your problem, at least from what I'm looking at on the issue preclusion.
We have a tough burden in our case. We have to show that their negligent supervision occurred during this narrow window of time.
But then, go ahead.
To say that the defense has numerous opportunities. They can argue, number one, and I believe they will, that either they did not have a duty, or that the duty was narrow in scope and was limited to a specific period of time. And I believe counsel is going to argue that that time period was June 1 to July 5, 1991. And so that if something happened in terms of negative supervision, it didn't happen on our watch. It happened outside that window.
Counsel, I'm trying to get to... Justice Wilcox said it well, the justice of it. I mean, if you were suing if you were suing them for an automobile accident, one of the fundamental elements of proof you'd have to show is that the accident occurred. Cool. And you're saying here, as I read this, you're saying we don't have to prove that the accident occurred.
Because
it's not an accident here, obviously. We don't have to prove that the underlying sexual assault occurred.
Because we believe that Michelle T. applies to this case, and that with respect to the application of issue preclusion, there's a five-prong test that this trial court went through and enumerated. And this court decided that on four of those five prongs, preclusion favored Paige and Caitlin, the two children, and therefore she was going to issue an order. The order that was issued in this case is two sentences long. The order says that for purposes of this litigation as to all defendants, Stephen Berndt did sexually assault plaintiff Paige and Caitlin Berndt between June 1 and August 1, 1991.
Next time, don't put your paper in front of the microphone because it won't get picked up. I'm sorry.
I apologize. The order is in the record. I think it's...
Whose order is that?
This is the order that forms the basis of this appeal. This is Judge Wolf's order at the trial court after having analyzed the fundamental fairness test under Michelle T. And the court says it's further ordered that all defendants are precluded from relitigating this issue. That's the order of March 6, 1997.
Well, the litigation that I see, or the relitigation, the issue of fairness then would fall with all they want to show is during the period of June 1st, 1991 and August 1st, that nothing happened.
That would be...
That's it, because the broadness, the sweep of this is that, yes, he was convicted of, sexual abuse, sexual assault, but that during that period of time, and that if they're precluded, in other words, they can't show anything, then it's sort of... an automatic res ipsa. In other words, it happened and then we're found negligent.
Well, that's going to be an issue of fact.
How do you get an issue of fact if you're limiting the discovery? I mean, who's going to testify? How are they going to make their case? That's what I'm...
How are we going to make our case? Yeah. Through other witnesses who will say that they saw Stephen Berndt alone with these children during that time period.
And then the other... prong, the other side, won't they be limited in saying no? In other words, what would their testimony be? How would they be able to show their case if you limit the discovery? That's just what I'm asking.
I would have to go outside of the record because I don't think the deposition transcripts...
Stay within the record.
The deposition transcripts are not part of the record, but there is testimony that they were with these children 24 hours a day during that time period. That's one of their defenses, that they performed their duty.
Are you going to allow them to raise that?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to allow them to raise that? Because that would go to the issue of whether these assaults occurred or not.
No, I don't think it does go to the issue. I think that's a credibility issue that the jury is going to have to judge at the time of trial. Whether they believe that these people were with them 24 hours a day. And there are going to be other witnesses that jury will hear that say, no, that's not the case. And that's up for the jury to decide. So I don't think that they can be prevented from giving that testimony.
But it would be settled, if you prevailed, that Stephen committed sexual assault on these two children sometime between June 1 and August 1, 1991. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the issue will be, even if you accept that, your position is, were they negligent in supervision?
Correct. In that time period.
Right. So even if he committed it during the time period, they might not have been negligent, but it happened anyway.
Correct.
Are you relying on any court order duty to supervise in your negligence supervision claim, or are you relying on the duty to give due care to everyone?
When Lorelei Blader, the mother, returned to the jurisdiction, she surrendered to the authorities, and as part of the arrangement that was worked out by counsel involved at the time, she agreed that the children would go back to Stephen's parents for supervision. This was then entered on May 24, 1991, in Judge Finn's record.
What I've read with regard to Finn is that as a condition of the bond that the then defendant, Lorelei, was required to take steps to see to it that the children are with the father's parents during the pendency of these proceedings unless otherwise ordered by a court of competent jurisdiction. Is it that phrase in the bond requiring the defendant to take steps, which is the basis of your assertion that the grandparents are under a legal duty to supervise?
There's more than that. There were discussions between the district attorney and Richard Berndt about supervision while the pendency of the investigation of Stephen Berndt's potential criminal conduct was occurring. There were a number of factual issues that we think created a duty.
And that's all in the record?
Correct. And whether it's the parent, grandparents, or anybody else.
And that's all in the record? Your response was correct?
Yeah,
it's all in the record.
Yes. Now Stephen, whether the grandparents or anybody else were supervising, the parental role here is not important. I mean, had this been a social worker who had agreed to undertake this, we would still be back to this negligent supervision issue, and I don't think that social worker in the subsequent trial would be able to come up with a defense that it didn't happen. Stephen Berndt didn't assault these children. That's all we've asked this court to do.
Counsel, I need to go back to my question. Maybe you didn't understand it. It seems to me that if the question is asked at trial, were you, to the grandparents, were you with these children at all times during this period, there would be a very appropriate objection made on the grounds of relevance, because that question is relevant only on the issue of whether or not these acts actually occurred. The question is being asked for the purpose of showing that nothing did happen because we were there all the time. And your position is, we don't have to try that anymore. That's been decided.
Do
you see the point that I'm...
With all due respect, Justice Pavlich, I believe that they would be able to answer that question. I think it's a credibility
issue. What relevance would it have?
Because they're going to say that they don't think this ever happened. These folks don't believe that this ever happened. And they'll say they were with those kids 24 hours a day. And if that jury wants to believe that, we lose. And if they don't, then we win. It's a credibility issue for the court.
But the response can be, it did happen, spot, we were not negligent in the supervision.
That would be another response, which again leads to questions of fact that are going to have to be resolved.
That's what you have to prove, negligent supervision. These children might have very well been supervised, and there was no fault, no blame on the grandparents. They did everything reasonable.
That'll be another issue. Correct.
Mr. Peterson, could I focus on the criminal jury for a moment?
Sure.
They found two counts of sexual contact. Could those counts have been based on incidents after July 5th, 1991?
Yeah, that's possible. That provides, and when Mr. Rundy gets up and says that defendant appellants have no defenses here, their constitutional right to a trial has been stripped away, it's not true. They have another window of defense. If the jury accepts Mr. Rundy's defense that the duty ended as of July 5, then another argument that the grandparents can make is it didn't happen on our watch. It happened sometime after July 5 and before August 1, 1991. Another defense.
But how do we know what the jury found in terms of when the offenses occurred?
In the criminal case? We only have the time frame. I unfortunately don't know other than that time frame.
Well, did the criminal complaint... It talks about June 1st to August 1st. Isn't there something about between May 24th and June 1st, too?
No.
Well, what happened on May 24th, 1991?
It's my understanding that the children were actually delivered to Richard and Esther Burnt at the Portage County Courthouse, and they took the children home with them that day.
So they were with the grandparents May 24 to June 1.
Correct.
Right.
When did Mom abscond with the kids to Cleveland?
After the order by Judge Finn providing custody and placement.
March 28th.
I'm sorry, Judge Mason.
March 28th, 1991, according to the brief.
I frankly don't remember the month, but that's...
Where were the children after... Is it July 5?
Well, there's some dispute about that, factually, and conflicting testimony. But either they were with Stephen Burnt after that point in time, or they were still with Richard and Esther Burnt, which is, again, we think an issue that has to be more fleshed out in discovery.
Okay. Your time is over. Counsel, Mr. Maloney.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is John Maloney, and I appear as co-counsel with Mark Peterson. And the red light was on for a little bit, so he took a little bit of my time as normal. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the court this morning. I'm here to discuss the role of this court in overseeing decisions of the trial court on discovery questions. And it was raised and dealt with in the Court of Appeals and is briefed here. The standard is abuse of discretion. This court has not, and it should not, involve itself in the nuts and bolts of discovery issues. We are here at a very preliminary stage before the Supreme Court. There has been no trial. There has been some discovery, but very little. This case was delayed for 2.5 years while our clients were not allowed to litigate while Stephen Burnt's conviction wound its way through the appellate court. He went to the Court of Appeals. He went back to the trial court. He went to this court by request for certiorari. He went to the United States Supreme Court. And only after those 2.5 years were expended did Judge Wolf then convene and listen to our motion for certain restrictions on the way in which discovery would be conducted. I do not believe that you should abandon past decisions. I believe the discretion of the trial court is paramount. You should not involve yourself in making these decisions. You should oversee what has been done. A few comments about discovery. Discovery should be resolved by lawyers. If lawyers can't resolve it, and I think most lawyers should resolve those disputes, the trial court should resolve it. This court should not. This court should not become involved in discovery issues. This court, this trial court, did an excellent job, in my opinion, as to the difficult set of facts. We represent a 2-year-old little girl and a 5-year-old little girl who were molested by a father and stepfather who was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of those actions.
Counsel, this has gone on for quite a while. The children are now, what, 13 and 10?
13 and 10, Your Honor. And let me get to that. The standard of review, as you well know, is reasonable application. Is there a reasonable basis for what Judge Wolf did? I submit to the court that there is an absolutely perfect way in which she dealt with these difficult problems. Please review, before I get there, let me comment on the 3 points. In order to review an abuse of discretion, you must not involve yourself in the decisions that she made, but you should examine the relevant facts to see whether she examined the relevant facts, apply the proper review of the law, and then did she demonstrate a rational process to reach a conclusion that a reasonable judge could reach. Now, I'm a trial lawyer. Judges have to make these decisions. The trial judge should make those decisions, and in this case, she did it, and she did it resoundingly. I would like you to look at the transcript in the appendix at Record 94. It's a 40-page transcript of a hearing in a series of hearings that resulted in the order on limitation of discovery that's before you today. 40 pages. Counsel is animated, aggressive. There are substantial disputes. Judge Wolf, in a well and analyzed decision, goes through the facts. She reviews the law under 80403 as to what her powers are to limit discovery. She derives at a rational process and a reasoned decision that a reasonable judge would do. Nothing she did here is unreasonable, and therefore you should not attack or review the specifics. Let me respond to a couple of things that were raised in Mr. Rundy's argument.
Mr. Maloney, let me interrupt for a minute. Let's assume that you lose on the issue preclusion. Do you go back to square one then in regard to your prohibitive order? In other words, your protective order on discovery?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
I will not give up on that because the trial court under 80403 has discretion to limit discovery. The trial court can deny depositions. It can deny discovery.
Didn't she base her decision on her view of whether or not issue preclusion was applicable here?
No. I think she, in a large measure, she made her decision based on the fact that my clients were 2 and 5, and even though they're 13 and 10, to interrogate a 13 and 10-year-old about a sexual assault 8 years ago was damaging, and she recognized it would be damaging to the children. There are better ways to elicit that information than by putting those little girls in a room and having a bunch of lawyers asking them questions that are extremely embarrassing.
Tell us what, if you will, the restrictions were that were placed on discovery.
I asked that Stephen Behrendt, who's a convicted felon who assaulted my clients, not be allowed to be in the room because I thought it would be intimidating. I asked that his mother and father not be in the room because it would be intimidating, and I asked that videotape and live time be used so they would be outside the room. Judge Wolf denied that request. Now, I don't think she was right, but I don't think you should change that because the trial court should make that decision.
What were her restrictions that she placed?
The restrictions she placed was there would be one questioner, all right, and all questions would be directed through that one questioner. She specifically ordered that Stephen Behrendt not be allowed to ask any direct questions to the children. Mr. Behrendt, the convicted felon, didn't want to ask any questions in the first deposition. He wanted to wait until his deposition. And Judge Wolf, Record 94, 40 pages, clearly says there will be one deposition, not multiple. She limited Paige to an hour and a half. She limited Caitlin to a half an hour. Caitlin was 2 years old when she was molested. Just asking her to think back to it is damaging. If you read Judge Wolf's transcript of that motion hearing, that is an examination of the facts, it's an application of the law, and it's a reasonable conclusion. Other restrictions.
She limit the scope of what could be asked?
There would be no discussion of the exact actions taken by Stephen, where he touched them, how he touched them, how they felt. There was questions posed. Let me get into, in the briefs, counsel cast aspersions on me and my partner that we want to prevent them from recounting the grisly details, and they say they don't have any intention of doing that. Let me quote from Record 94 what Mr. Rundy told the trial court his position was. About Paige, her recollection of events might be considerably more rich. 5-year-old girl, about his intentions. We need to find out each and every abuse that they allege occurred, her recollection of what type of abuse occurred during those time periods. Direct quote. As to time limits, I don't think it's reasonable to impose a time restriction on it. None. That's why the deposition cannot be brief. As to his intentions, we need to know the nature and extent of the abuse that occurred. Ask her questions about what type of sexual abuse occurred, how it occurred, the circumstances under which it occurred, and what her response to it was. Further, he asked the judge, can I ask her questions as to whether the touching was over clothing or under clothing? And Judge Wolf said, no, you're not going to ask that question. Because the abuse, the finding of fact that Richard abused them is established. It's a proven fact.
Well, then it seems to me that you answered Justice Crooks's question mistakenly, because Justice Crooks said, well, didn't her ruling depend upon her belief or her decision on the issue of preclusion?
In part it does, and I didn't mean to misstate that.
So she may, but see, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, if in fact we say that there is no issue of preclusion and that the defendant, the grandparents can go into this questioning themselves, then maybe we should send it back to the judge to reconsider the time limits based upon the new areas of questioning that's going to be allowed.
If you read, Justice Babich, if you read Judge Wolf's transcript, and as trial lawyer, I've had a lot of motion hearings. I rarely read a transcript in hindsight that I was as proud of the work that a trial judge did, because it was a reasoned approach. Let me tell you, going back to Justice Crooks for just a moment, another restriction that was imposed was that the questions had to be addressed to the court in advance so that the court would look at them to approve them. Because, and I didn't ask for that, the guardian ad litem asked for that. And I've not had that experience as a trial lawyer, but let me tell you how we got there. In the middle of this evidentiary hearing, I told the court that Richard and Esther Behrendt have filed a counterclaim against Lorelei Blader, in which they allege that the mother abused these children. And I told the court that Mr. Rundy had indicated to me that he was going to ask these girls if their mother had ever demonstrated or taught them to use a device to sexually gratify themselves. He was going to ask that 5-year-old or that 2-year-old those questions. And when Judge Wolf heard that, she said, we're not doing that. I want all the questions that are going to be submitted to these children in writing for me to look at ahead of time. And you know what? That's a good decision. Because if he asked that question in deposition, I would pack up my bags, I would take my children, and I would leave that deposition because I would not tolerate that, and we just keep going back to Judge Wolf. This is a solid decision on discovery.
Counsel, you have outlined, you've stated verbatim the court's protective order on pages 5 and 6 of your brief.
Correct.
I read this correctly. You have a little issue about Steve Behrendt not being pro se, and he isn't permitted to see the questions until the deposition.
That is correct. We never got that far. We're here because that order was appealed from. One last thing I'd like to correct from the record. Mr. Rundy did indicate that we had moved for summary judgment against Stephen Behrendt. We have not. It's sitting in a pile in my partner's office for the last 2 years while we've wound our way here. We intended to file that motion. We believe that Judge Wolf will grant summary judgment on liability as against him, but she will not grant summary judgment against Esther and Richard Behrendt, because we have to prove that they negligently supervised these children and that they caused these injuries.
And G says, on page 6, there shall be no questions directed to the children as to what was done to them by Stephen Behrendt. And this is what you would say.
Correct.
The court had previously determined, pursuant to the issue conclusion order, that sexual assaults between June 1 and August 1 were proven as to all defendants.
Correct.
So what are you going to ask the children? Or what can be asked the children?
If you read the transcript again, and I hate to keep going back to it,
all
but
right.
Mr. Rundy pose certain questions. The first question he asks is, did your father touch you? That is an appropriate question.
That is or isn't?
That is an appropriate question. But did he,
obtain penetration? Did he take your clothes off? You got to protect these. Judge Wolf protected these two little girls. All right? We're not going to preclude them. Look back to the order that Mr. Peterson referred you to. The order says that for purposes of this lawsuit, the fact that Stephen Berndt assaulted these girls is a fact. That doesn't mean that they violated their duty to supervise. It doesn't mean that they're liable. We have a burden to prove that that assault happened on their watch. And we would welcome that burden, and we look forward to proving that.
You have a burden to prove that the assault happened and that the assault happened on their watch. Those are two separate questions, right, counsel?
I believe that the fact that the assault happened under issue of the preclusion is established.
Yeah, right.
But I have to prove that it happened on their watch or I can't recover against them. Look, I'm going to recover against Stephen Berndt.
Not only on their watch, but that they were negligent on their watch.
Correct. But with the knowledge they had, you're not a trial judge, so I won't make my passion argument, but...
Mr. Maroney, doesn't the type of actions that the man engaged in, that Stephen engaged in, go to also the damages?
Yeah, yes, it does. And one of the issues that we had to make up our mind on whether we'd even take this case is, would we do more damage to the girls by bringing this case than we would by not bringing it? And we made the decision we take this case because the fact of the assault had been established, and we felt that we could protect these girls from being interrogated as to the grisly details. And Judge Wolf, in her decision, I believe, has a framework. She didn't do everything I'd like her to have done, but she has a framework to protect those girls, and I think we can try this case and get a fair day in court without further damaging them. There are other witnesses who could be used to testify as to what those damages are, medical expenses, psychological expenses, the mother who's been deposed. There are alternatives, Justice Crooks.
Well, in order to probe whether or not those damages are legitimate, don't you think that there's some questions that have to be asked about what occurred?
Some questions, yes. And if you read the transcript again, and I'll close with this, Judge Wolf addressed certain questions. Mr. Rundy went through a litany of them. And the outrageous ones, she said, you're not going to ask that. And the general ones, were you alone? Did they happen at Grandma's house? No problem. Was Grandma present in the house? What room in the house? Did your dad touch you? All acceptable questions. But you can't give them free rein to relitigate and try to prove that it didn't happen. It happened. Richard and Esther Berndt today, if they were under oath, and they were when I deposed them, would tell you this didn't happen. It has been established. It happened.
Counsel, are you at all able to prepare to address the issue of preclusion issue? Or that?
Not as articulately as my partner, but I'd be happy to try.
Thank you. I have a question, and that deals with the legal definition of identity of interest. In order to have issue preclusion, there has to be an identity of interest, and it's defined as one who prosecutes or assists in the prosecution or defense of an action in aid of some interest of his own, and thus should be bound. Did these grandparents prosecute or assist in the prosecution or defense of an action in aid of some interest of their own?
They were on the witness list of the criminal trial. All right, they were not called as witnesses. I took the deposition of both these people. Their testimony in this deposition, or in this case, that will eventually get here probably in a few years, hopefully, is that they were with these children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it would seem to me that if that was the case, that might have been interesting in the criminal process too, as a defense. I don't know why they weren't called. I don't know why they didn't testify. I think they have an identity of interest in the sense of the order and the agreement. The district attorney, and the proof will be that the district attorney went to Richard Berndt, called him in his office and said, will you take these children to your home while we sort this out? They agreed. They assumed a duty. If they breach that duty, they're liable.
But issue preclusion has nothing to do with an intermediate order. It has to do with the prior litigation, whether that issue that was determined in the prior litigation should be precluded from relitigation.
And under my understanding is under the Michelle T5 fact test, you don't have to have complete compliance with all five of those items. In fact, I think this court has in some cases ruled as many as three of the five are acceptable, and Judge Wolf, again, in a prior order, not my favorite order, okay, in a different record, the hearing, I believe, in February of 24th, she went through the exact five-point test and found in favor of the little girls on four of those five.
Thank you, counsel.
Sorry to run over here.
All right. Ms. Grundy?
Your Honor, thank you. I've only got 5 minutes. I'm going to make the most of it. But I will tell you this, that they are absolutely dead wrong when they cite Michelle T. as the standard. They are wrong. Michelle T., the reason that Michelle T. is the wrong case is because in Michelle T., it's the same guy. Crozer was the defendant in the earlier criminal conviction. Therefore, when the civil case came along, the court asked the question whether or not that criminal conviction could be used against him. The court said yes. They didn't have to deal with the identity of interest, the privity issue. Go back to the Montana decision again. If you lay Montana next to Crozier, you're going to see that the Montana court held that before issue preclusion can apply, you have to have the identity of interest that Justice Bradley just noted. Only then, and if you look at Montana, you will see that the five-part test for Michelle came from Montana. That's where this court lifted that five-part test.
Did we cite Montana?
Yes.
Okay.
Read Montana, read Michelle T., and you will see that before you get to the five-part test of Michelle T., you have to get to issue, you have to get to privity. And the respondents in their brief at page 16, privity is not required for issue preclusion. That is their position, page 16 of their brief. They are wrong. It is. It's the fundamental bedrock of issue preclusion. You have to have privity. And I have to make a comment about Record 94. I am being, it is being stated that I wanted to ask these scurrilous questions of these children. I am deferential to a court order. I was being told I could only ask certain questions. And I said, well, Judge, so I don't run into a problem in this deposition. I'd like to know now what kinds of questions I can ask. And you know, I hadn't prepared for a deposition. I was in a court hearing, but I started asking questions because I wanted to know the liability issue, the damages issue. Justice Crooks is right. How can I defend a case on damages when I don't get to ask the question, what happened? How can my expert, the preeminent authority in child abuse cases, if he's not able to ask, not only were the lawyers not able to ask these children what happened, the judge ordered my expert can't ask these children what happened. Now, how can I defend the case?